We're at the corner of Sunset and Vine. Not exactly at the corner, but at approximately the corner of Sunset and Vine, in a building that has replaced the old NBC studios. This is a Savings and Loan Association building now, and we are in the club room, I guess, of the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, speaking with the, I guess, the immediate past president of this organization,
no,
Bill Baldwin.
They worked it out, and I said yes, and so I'm trapped for another year. So it's unprecedented. It's been a two-year term. And so today was my first board meeting, and we are now 3 years, starting our third year as president.
Well, if it was, you know, FDR embarked upon his political career like that.
Right.
So you may very well follow in those footsteps. Bill, you've been involved in radio in what we lovingly call the old days, but also in the present days, and involved in broadcasting and telecasting and all that. Where did it all begin for you?
Well, I was born in Pueblo, raised in Denver, Colorado. Could never get a job in Denver. I auditioned, and they said, you'll never make an announcer, and sometimes I think they're right. And so I went to work for walkathons, and that's before your time, and being an MC. And we had four MCs a day over a 24-hour period in walkathons, and the chief MC was a fellow named Red Skelton. Well, when they finally closed us up after a couple of years and they got smart to us all over the country, we were making money, you can't believe. I was out of work, but the walkathon, every night we did a radio broadcast of what was going on and how, sort of a special events news type of thing, but it was play-by-play, really, or foot-by-foot. And I got training there and had no idea of going into radio. So the orchestra leader, his name was Harry Collins, was out of Grand Island, Nebraska, and I used to sing with the band as well as announce. You did everything then. Mm-hmm. And he called and he said, we're going to open with the band in Casper, Wyoming. Would you like to come out and sing with us? Well, I had no money, no job, so I said, sure. So I arrived in Casper, Wyoming. And we were on radio there. You couldn't get a 5 miles out of town, but it was radio. Mm-hmm. And they had the announcer. And one night, being the vocalist, the announcer didn't show up, so I did the broadcast. Now, for a week prior to this time, a gentleman had come up every night and said, do you play the Nebraska fight song? He'd been at the bar. And, of course, the band being from Grand Island, we played it. And every time we played the Nebraska fight song, he'd send a round of drinks for the band. So, consequently, every 20 minutes, we played the Nebraska fight song. Well, this night, if the announcer didn't show up, I did the broadcast. And the same gentleman came up and said, who did the broadcast? And the announcing, and Harry said, Bill Baldwin. And he said, have him in my room tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Well, I went up. He remembered everything that had taken place. And he picked up the telephone and called Harry Burke at WOW in Omaha. And he said, I found your new announcer. And I got on the phone and talked to him. And that's how I got really into radio, was to be the announcer on a band remote in Casper, Wyoming, to go to WOW in Omaha. And that was in 1936. They didn't take a chance, though. They farmed me out for about 5 months to KFXJ, the voice of the Western Slope, Grand Junction, Colorado. And we had no news wire. I read Christian Science Monitor newspapers that arrived every day, and that was the news. And then I went to Omaha and from there to the networks, and that was the beginning.
You found yourself in Chicago at one period of time.
Oh, yes. I went directly from WOW to WGN in Chicago. When Quinn Ryan was there and Myrtle Stahl, and I became the king of the band remotes. And at night I would do all the band remotes starting at 6 o'clock and finish up at 1 o'clock in the morning. Every other half hour I had a show.
Were you doing that from the studio or site?
No, from the site. That's why every half hour or hour we'd start out with dinner music at the Blackstone and then go to the Palmer House and then to the Blackhawk, to the Drake, back to the Palmer House and sign off at the Blackhawk at night with the Midnight Flyers. The people back there that remember that will remember that.
Now, this was usually through the week, right?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. This was 5 days, 6 days a week.
So this was the kind of programming WGN was presenting at that time.
Well, at night they were known as the Band Network Mutual. They were the mutual main mutual outlet out of Chicago in the western area, or the central area. And they were known as the Band Network all over the country, and made a great name for themselves. During the day, and this was BU before unions, you made around a fast 50, 55 a week and all you could steal, you know. Or I would be doing shows for Marshall Field or somebody else on the ball games with Bob Elson, and they'd send over a carton of cigarettes and a bottle of booze. You know, that was the money instead of salary at that time. Then came the union. But during the day, we had the soap operas, just like NBC and WBBM at CBS. And the variety shows, and of course the great WGN orchestra and a concert orchestra, Henry Weber and Marion Clare, all of the great and wonderful
Chicago
people.
Chicago Theater of the
Air.
Yes,
yes. And I used to broadcast from there on the weekends from the park with Frederick Stock and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
That was quite a different scene for Chicago in those days than it is today in radio.
Oh, yes.
Of course, radio has changed so much. I want to jump back to that point when you were moving from ballroom to ballroom. Did you ever get a problem? Did you ever get stuck with the bridge being up or something like that?
Not really, because the only one I had outside of the bridge development situation there was the Drake Hotel. And no, I never did get trapped that way. The only time I remember the bridge being up was being at one of the theaters one afternoon for a matinee. And John Barrymore was doing his great thing, and one of the bridges was up, and you know when the whistles sound, when the bridge is up, and it just kept whistling and whistling and whistling. And finally Mr. Barrymore walked down right to the lights, and they said, "Would somebody go out and shut off that damned whistle?" And then went back into doing the act. No, I've heard of people getting caught.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they used to, you know, work from GN to BBM to MAQ, and they were flying all
that
over
was the freelance performer.
Right.
You know, we were staff announcers at that time, which is almost a thing of the past now. Mm-hmm. It's gone. The real true staff announcer.
As a staff announcer, then you got a single salary for your
that
week's work, right?
That was it.
And no matter what they asked you to do, you had to do it.
That's right. All the commercials, all the breaks, the from morning till night. You know, you could sign off at 1 o'clock at night and be back on the air at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they could work you. That wasn't just WGN, that was everywhere.
They all did that.
Oh yes,
yeah.
That was everywhere.
From Chicago, where did you go, Bill?
I went for a short spell to Shreveport, Louisiana, and that was only because I developed an ulcer in Chicago, and there was a nice sanitarium-type hospital down there, and WGN had a do-bill-type thing. And I went down and went to work at KWKH, the old W.K. Henderson station. That was an experience in itself. Mm-hmm. And then back to Omaha, and went to KOIL in Omaha, the KOIL, Barnstall Oil, B square to your motor. That was the old. Yeah, it's amazing how you can remember those things.
Grab them right out of there.
And right. Then went from there to. I got a little tired of sitting in Omaha again, and the roller derbies came through. Now a lot of people think the roller derby came with television, but the roller derby was 1938, and I went with the roller derbies from there to Denver to Hollywood, and that's my first trip into Hollywood to work or do anything like that. And we went from here to San Francisco, and I arrived in San Francisco in December of 38, and the roller derby left, but I was asked by CBS. In the meantime, on all these stations and things I'd been doing, I developed a news thing, and before disc jockeys, a record show, I always tried to do the morning show, because by 1 o'clock you're soon you can go play golf or do something, you know. And I created somewhat of a name in that field of morning shows and doing news. Well, the fair was to open in April, really, but they had pre-broadcasting of the World's Fair in San Francisco in 1939. And CBS asked me if I would stay in San Francisco and be their special events man at the fair. And so I stayed, and stayed through 1939, and back to Omaha after the fair closed. And we stayed there. I married my wife in 1940, my wife Enid, and she was with one of the stations in Omaha Lincoln. And from there,
I was wondering why you kept going back to Omaha. Now I know. See?
Well, no, I didn't met her there. It was always a safe. I could always get a job there. You know, it was good to have, and I could always go back to KOIL. I don't know where else I would have gone, really. But I never got back to Chicago or east. I never worked out of New York, except later when I was doing network stuff with Edgar Bergen and a few of those. But then I, my wife and I married, left, went to Salt Lake City, stayed there a year, were picked up on the air there and sent to Hollywood, to KFWB here in Hollywood. The war hit December 7th, and here came the news again. And Blue Network then, which is now ABC, said, we need a news director in San Francisco. And so I went, and they moved us lock, stock, and barrel. And from that time, I had no idea that they were grooming me to be a war correspondent. And I went overseas for the Blue Network in 1943. 44, came home 45. And there was nothing more dead in the world after the war than a war correspondent, and for radio especially. So I went to freelancing in San Francisco and stayed there until 1949. And a thing came along, a picture called Champion. And Stanley Kramer said, I would like you to come down and play the fight announcer. So I did, and that was July of 49. We moved down here and been here ever since.
Let's move back to the middle 40s when you were a war correspondent. What were the duties of a network war correspondent at that time?
Unlike today, the Vietnamese War, the Korean conflict, etc., at that time we had four networks. ABC, not ABC, but the Blue Network, NBC, CBS, and Mutual. Each of the four networks had four war correspondents. Now imagine this. 16 broadcasters, four for each network, covered the entire World War II. Now we had stringers that would help out at times, but each of us had an engineer. So eight men would cover an entire World War II for the Blue Network, for NBC, each, eight men. My assignment was the Pacific Theater of Operation. I worked out of Hawaii and traveled from there. Cleet Roberts, who is considered one of the finest and is still here in Los Angeles, was assigned to General MacArthur, and he is an expert on the exploits of General MacArthur. Martin, I'll think of the name in a moment.
Gransky?
No. Was assigned to the CBI Theater with General Chenault and the others in the China-Burma Theater, and the great George Hicks was assigned to the European Theater of Operation with General Eisenhower, etc. And the four of us covered the entire war for the Blue Network. As I said, we had the stringers. Today, you have 100-man bureaus in each city, so to speak. For instance, out here, in Sacramento alone, the capital of the state of California, each television station has a minimum of 40 broadcasters, newscasters on that station, you know, working news people. So that's how it has increased. Of course, at that time, we were held to strict secrecy. We did not have satellite. When I went out and covered the carrier, the first fast carrier strike against Japanese-held waters, which was after the Marianas Turkey shoot and those other conflicts of great magnitude, we did not have shortwave. We could not tell even the ships we were on even to send the tapes back that maybe would not be played for 2-3 weeks because of security of where we were. So we did not have to come into your living room immediately on these operations. In fact, it was better that you didn't because of security reasons. I was gone 4 weeks on that one trip alone, and no one knew where we were because Admiral Nimitz and Admiral Halsey did not reveal where we were at any time during that 4 weeks. But when we came back, pop, you know, you got the air and went from there.
You implied an answer to a question I was about to ask you. How did the word get from the Pacific, where you were, to the radio listener here? You took an engineer with you. You mentioned the word tape.
Yes.
But were you using tape then?
Well, it was not really tape. What it was, if you remember, we had the old 16-inch transcription, and it had to sit flat, and the needle would come down and emboss the material on aluminum. Well, when the war hit, you couldn't get aluminum. Therefore, those discs were made of glass. But beside the fact that that head would bounce all over the place with, you know, you fire a 3-inch gun or the ship move, and it would move. So the Navy got together with a company called Ampro, and they developed a 35-millimeter, 50-foot endless belt of film. And that 50-foot endless belt would pass over a needle that was locked into place that would emboss, and that needle would move. And that was the first time you could ever edit, because you could count lines and move with that needle embossing, and you could play it back and play it back and play it back, which you couldn't do on the 16-inch transcription. That's what we called tape at that time, but it was 35-millimeter embossed film. Mm-hmm. Then they would take that and transfer it to the 16-inch transcriptions. Getting it back, I had a boss, and he lives in New Jersey still. His name is Johnny Johnstone. He had been prior to that with Walter Winchell. Mm-hmm. Johnny was the news director of Blue Network. He's the one that hired us. And he had the smarts, and he, at that time, you couldn't get good booze, you know, good mm-hmm. drinking material. You were, well, we won't go into craft names, but it was bad. Uh-huh. But there was some to be had, uh-huh. and he would send it out to Red Sanders, was mm-hmm. my engineer. We covered the world. And he would send it out in a wooden box marked radio tubes or radio equipment gear, and you open it up, and here is good sipping whiskey. Now, we wouldn't drink it. What we would do when we're on the way out to a story would drop it off at the different sensors or the air bases mm-hmm. for the doctors or something like that, and no one could ever figure out how come Baldwin's Blue Network tapes always got back to Honolulu first. They just never stopped. Zap, they'd go right through. You know, the sensors mm-hmm. wouldn't go through them or anything else. On this particular one, I knew we had an exclusive. Do you have time for
yes,
this?
Yes, sure, of course.
When this operation took place, and it was in October of 1944, it was the first fast carrier task force strike into Japanese-held waters. We'd never been there before. Mm-hmm. When our fleet was stretched out, it was the third fleet. It was 37 miles long and 17 miles wide, and a ship every 2,000 yards. So you can imagine how many we had. The Japanese were very good at counterintelligence, and so from Honolulu, even, they dispatched one of us from each of the four networks. Bud Foster from NBC, Tim Lamert from CBS here, and I forget who the mutual man was at this time. But they dispatched the four of us on separate days in separate directions to not let the Japanese know that we're heading out for a big major story, because they never assigned broadcast correspondents unless it was a major story. Well, mine, I went to the Johnson Islands, to Saipan, got a ship there that flew us out of there flying. Oh, man, it was something. They had 16 torpedo warheads mm-hmm. in the thing, and if we'd ever hit, that's all she wrote, you know. And we flew to a place called Ulithi that was, you couldn't find it on a map. And I looked down, and there's the entire Third Fleet sitting right there. And we landed, went aboard, first time in real big combat. And 4 weeks later, we finished the operation. We'd been through two typhoons. We'd been all over the Pacific. Admiral Halsey did it again and had a story. As we pulled out and were refueling at sea with a carrier on each side doing 30 knots with an oiler giving us gasoline and oil and the aviation fuel, a war correspondent had just come out from Hawaii, and he came aboard and he said, "Bill, you've got an exclusive." And I said, "You're kidding. The other three are the rest." He said, "No, they got caught in Australia in a typhoon and were not able to get out. You have the only broadcast story." Well, that's one in a lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
So I asked permission to send a visual message to Admiral Halsey and told him of what I had just found out. Could he expedite my getting back to Honolulu? Mm-hmm. We're 75 to 100 miles off Tokyo now. And off the Japanese-held land, rather. And he came back and said yes, and they transferred me by breeches buoy, and that's an interesting thing if you've never been transferred from ship to ship on a line. And I had 29 hours of tape boxes under my arm, and that's all. And they did it at midnight with no lights. They handed me a big, long, white pole, and I said, "What's that?" And they said, "Hold on to it. If we drop you, turn it up. It's got a light. We can find you." So we had no lights, you know, under complete secrecy. And they transferred me to a destroyer, then to another carrier, to Admiral Halsey, who gave me my papers, and he's smart, too. He gave me a pad of 25 copies of his orders, making me an officer courier so that no one could touch me, could stop me. I was under orders from the Admiral of the Third Fleet to report to the Admiral of the Pacific Fleet, Admiral Nimitz in Hawaii. Censors couldn't touch me. Oh, and they died. They died because they hadn't knew, they didn't know where we were for 4 weeks.
Mm.
And I finally wound up on a Jeep carrier. They flew me off to a place called Babel Thwap, which was under fire, put me on a plane, and got me back to Hawaii. And 72 hours from the time I left the fleet, I was on the air. And Admiral Halsey had held radio silence till I got there. My material was cleared, written, and everything else, you know, so we could broadcast. And I was the pool. I had the first 5 minutes had to be a pool operation for all four networks to accept. Then I could go on my own. And they radioed Admiral Halsey that I had arrived, and he went on the air 30 seconds before me and said, "This is Admiral William F. Halsey, so-and-so. I have raised all ships sunk by Radio Tokyo and am retreating toward the enemy. I'll never forget it as long as I live." And he said, "And now, here's Bill Ballin." I had to wait 30 seconds for the switch and went on the air, and that was it. And I still have tapes of it. It's one of the great thrills of my life.
One of the most exciting war stories I've ever heard.
Oh, yeah. He got me back and got it on the air. Then I waited a minute after the five and fed my network, the Blue Network, all of the sound. Nobody had ever recorded them before. They had never had the opportunity, well, put it that way, of the actual being under fire and our guns firing and what goes on. It's like a football field when you look down from the carrier and see what's going on. It was a thrill.
Did you broadcast that from Hawaii then?
Oh, yes.
It went live then?
It went to San Francisco by shortwave, no satellite, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did one show out of there, speaking of that, and they would come back and give you a 4-0, you know, 0-4-0 for acceptance on the shortwave, whether it was good receiving, good quality or whatever. And one, I had sent them a 15-minute show that I'd worked on for about 3 weeks. This was long after them. Mm-hmm. And to show you what can happen on shortwave. And I sent it to them, and I didn't hear back, you know, the report. So I got on the thing again, and I said, "Well, would you please give it?" Because I marked every script of what it was, 3, 8, 5, mm-hmm. 6, you know. They said, "What broadcast?" And they'd fed it, and it hadn't even hit the lines there, so I entertained millions of fish somewhere between Hawaii and San Francisco. But that was just one portion of a real goodie. Mm-hmm. A lot of work. I later went out and did a submarine war patrol, but it was very exciting, but it was not as exciting as the first one you're in. You know, like
you were in danger much of the time then, weren't you?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. The casualty rate of war correspondents is the greatest of all of the services. And was at that time, yes. Because they're non-combatant, no sidearms, no knives, no nothing like that in case of war. You are given a rank, whether if you're in the Army or the Marine Corps, you're a major. If you're in the Navy, you're a lieutenant commander. That is in case of capture and prisoner of war, so that you have the rights and privileges as an officer, officer, and that's part of the Geneva Conference.
Otherwise, if you were as a civilian, you could be a spy, I suppose.
Oh, sure. Sure. Some great and wonderful man. Many people say, "Did you ever meet Ernie Pyle?" I met Mr. Pyle only once. I was with him for about 2 hours in Honolulu and felt that he'd been my friend for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Great man. There's some great, wonderful people. In Chicago, for instance, we had three Smiths out in the Pacific, and you'd say, "Where's Packrat?" And you knew who they were talking about, or "Where's Horrible or Wonderful?" Well, those were the three Smiths. Wonderful was Eugene W. Smith, Time Life photographer. And they asked him what W was, and he said wonderful, so he got that name. Packrat was Harold Smith of the Chicago Tribune. He would run a minefield to pick up something to send back to the colonel to have for a bond rally, you know, so they could raffle it off to sell war bonds at that time. And Horrible Smith was a wonderful man who was a newsreel photographer for Path A News, and he'd just walk around and say, "Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible." So that's how he got his name.
the codes, huh?
Oh, yes, sure.
You found yourself in Hollywood then, you said about
1949. I mean, the second time. Moved back and been here ever since.
After the war and all of that other business. What was your first job here then?
Well, it was either move to Hollywood from San Francisco or stay in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to better myself. However, I was working very hard in San Francisco. First television show I ever did was the first show ever on KPIX, the first station there. And money wasn't that big up there at all. And you know, work yourself to death for the money you could get.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to make the move and talked with my wife, and she said, well, we'll make the move without a job. But I kept two shows on Sunday in San Francisco, and I would, you know, commute. And I fell into my first real job here was as an announcer at the Palladium, going back to the band network days of doing that while working and looking for another job. On a plane running from San Francisco to Los Angeles on one of those Sundays, I met a gentleman named Paul Lewis sitting next to me on the plane, and I said, what do you do? He said, I'm with the Darcy Advertising Agency. I said, what do you do? He said, well, we handle the Coca-Cola account. I said, what are you going to Hollywood for? He said, to find an announcer for the Edgar Bergen show. Well, you know, two and two make four. And I said, I'm an announcer, and I'm going back to Hollywood. He said, no. He said, we've auditioned 26 announcers already, and they won't do what we want. We don't want them to sell Coca-Cola. We want them just to suggest Coca-Cola after the show is over. So I said, well, look, can I get in on the audition? He said, we're going to audition actors. I said, I'm an actor. I just finished Champion. So So he said, all right. And by golly, he called me, and I walked in, and I knew that this fine actor, Theodore Von Els, had won the show, because when he came out of the control room, he had a smile that wide, you know, 2 feet wide. So they called me in, and I look in the booth, and you've been through this, and there must have been 20 people in that booth listening to that audition. I think at WGN they had the best idea. When you were auditioning, they had a big curtain that went down over that glass, and you could see nobody, and they couldn't see you. No. They bought your voice. But here there were 20 people. So they handed me the thing, and it was the benediction. At that time, Coca-Cola had only 15 seconds on the opening of the show and 15 seconds on the close, and that was their commercial with Sunday Afternoon with Edgar Bergen and Mario Alonso, which I did later. And it was, and remember, whoever you are, whatever you do, wherever you may be, when you think of refreshment, think of Coca-Cola, for ice cold Coca-Cola is everywhere. I read it, put the thing down, walked out. They said, you wouldn't mind reading it again, you know, half miffed at me. And I said, no. I read it, and the door opened, and Edgar Bergen walked out and said, welcome to the club.
Oh.
And that was it. And 7 years with Edgar, and then we went into television for a little bit. And now Edgar is chairman of the board of the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, and I'm the president of PPB. We've been on Tom Snyder's show a couple of times out of New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got on the radio scene with Edgar Bergen then after he had completed his long association with Chase and Sanborn.
Yes, Edgar had remembered to divide the so you know, everybody said, we associate you with. So Edgar went off the air for one whole year. It wasn't on the air at all. That's when he left Chase and Sanborn and went with the Coca-Cola company. And we were with Coca-Cola, and then we went with cosmetics outfit, too, later. But yes, that was afterward. Ken Carpenter, who is a vice president of Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, was an announcer with Edgar for those years. But not many people remember, but I was the announcer the longest time with Edgar. Well, Don Amici was an announcer for a while. Bill Goodwin was an announcer.
Was Bill Goodwin with Bergen?
He was early. Yes, Bill was early with Charlie.
Well, now were you working exclusively for Bergen on that, or were you freelancing?
No, I was freelancing, but signed to the Bergen show.
I see.
I could not do any other product that associated itself with Coca-Cola. To show you. Even today, not as much, but then it was very important. I was asked to audition for the Burns and Allen television show. And I hope Von Zell's listening, because I remind him of this all the time. and I went over and I auditioned for it and had it. And I went to Coca-Cola, and I don't know why, and I just said, look, I'm going to be doing the Burns and Allen show. I've been asked to do the Burns and Allen show for Carnation. And they said, oh. And I said, is that all right with you? They said, it's fine with us, but if you do that show, you can't do Coca-Cola. You can't do the Bergen show, nor Mario Lanza. And I had them both. And I was doing all of their spots at that time, too, and their early television commercials. And I said, why? They said, look, if you drink a glass of milk and they pitch orange juice, or you eat ice cream, you won't drink a Coca-Cola. And when you stop and think about it, it makes sense.
Well, it's true, yeah.
So I didn't get it, and Von Zell got it, and he's a millionaire.
What else did you do, Bill, in the radio and the television things now into the 50s? You were well into the 50s with Bergen.
Oh, yes. Radio-wise, well, as I said, the Mario Lanza show, which was a great education. He was a wonderful man. He was wonderful to me. It's a shame what happened to his life because he was such a talent. The Jack Kirkwood shows was one, and that's an education, too. That was...
Kirkwood was really a zany kind of
Yeah, was he and his wife and daughter, and George Wright was the great organist. We had two sound effects technicians and a director, J.C. Lewis, that they drove up a wall every day because Kirk would walk in and said, "To hell with him, we won't rehearse, we'll go over and have coffee." And he'd go crazy.
Was this the half-hour Kirkwood or the 15-minute?
No, this was the half-hour Kirkwood. He had done the 15-minute for Oxidol or something on CBS. This was on Mutual, and it was live, 5 days a week radio. And fun, and 4 years, and I played straights to him and played parts and everything else, and he found out I could not do an Irish accent worth anything, and every other show he'd throw in the Irish policeman just to say, "See, that's all he can do is announce." You know? But he was a great and wonderful man.
You worked with Walter O'Keefe for a while, too, didn't you?
Yes, Beat the Odds was the name of the show on CBS.
Beat the Odds.
Yes, this was long after his Double or Nothing and the famous breakup. But let's see, from there to, oh, goodness sakes, other radio shows. Well, it played a lot of parts in shows. And then went back into a little bit of special eventing around, and now television started to sneak in. And that's when we were doing the billboards on shows. Then I went with, in 1956, with Robert Cummings, who was with Bob for 6 years on the show when he was the photographer. And Paul Henning, God bless him, the writer and producer of those shows. Paul did for me what very few performers got the right to do, and that was use your own name. And so I was always the announcer, Bill Baldwin, on the show. And when the Beverly Hillbillies came along, which he did, I played Bill Baldwin at KBH, the voice of Beverly Hills, Drive Carefully, Protect Our Millionaires, you know, and all of these. And that was 9 years of great and wonderful time. On all of those shows, we had different sponsors. On Beverly Hillbillies, for instance, the first 5 years was for Winston. And the same with the Bob Cummings show. So they just stayed right with that announcer. Like Hal Sims, he has certain shows. Ken Roberts had certain shows. Ken Carpenter had certain shows. And you stayed with those sponsors and were identified with them. Or an agency that had multi-products. But now the more or less, you cannot find, I don't think, outside of the Bell Telephone Hour, I could be very wrong, a show that is sponsored by a product, maybe a special once in a while.
A special occasionally, and that's
like,
about it.
Like the Texaco thing with Bob Hope and a few things like
Xerox,
that.
Or Xerox.
Yes, but never across the board. I don't think you will find across the board shows sponsored by a sponsor anymore. It's multi-sponsors.
It's just too expensive.
Yes,
for
that's
them
true.
To do it. Of course, that's what... That's what has changed the face of broadcasting, I believe.
Yes.
In the so-called old days, they used to complain that the control of the program was in the lap of the sponsor, and they said that wasn't good.
And the agency, that's right.
Well, the agency sponsor, and that wasn't good, and they looked forward to the day when the network would have the control. And that's today
now. And that's
today. And I don't know that we have the same kind of
And some of the major production companies have control, you know, like... ABC has their shows that they do. NBC has theirs. CBS is aligned with so and so. Oh boy, I tell you, it's a rat race today for the performer. I can say this with my other hat on now, as a former national president of AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, where the union was born, by the way, in Chicago. The Chicago Union was underneath the street that between WBBM and WGN. They used to meet down there in that little restaurant behind a furnace and sit down. That's where the union started down there. That's become a great union. We're highly thought of. It's very highly thought of. But the union came along, and thank God, because you used to make a commercial for $4.11, and it could play 13 weeks all over the country unlimited. And now they're protecting our people. They have not priced themselves out of the industry. We try to work with the organizations and with the people. So it's one of those things that Some unions have white hats. May I put it that way? Are the white hats.
Well, you're
as Screen Actors Guild is, white hat.
Yeah. You're a good guy with a white hat.
Oh, sure.
You've talked a lot about your great contribution to broadcasting, and it's been very interesting. We appreciate this chance to share these moments with you.
It's great to be here and to be with you and to be able to share them. And I lecture at universities across the country, and I keep telling these people, go find a little coffee pot. Don't go to the big city first. Go find a little station.
Right.
Learn your craft there. Learn your trade. Sell your product. Learn the agency. And always remember that that microphone is human, because when they turn it on and invite you in, they've invited you into their home. And when they turn it off, they've slammed the door if they don't like you on that program. So that microphone's pretty human.
I think we've had the door open through this conversation. Thanks, Bill Baldwin.
Thank you.